Hello again and welcome to Musings on Golf, where we will be telling great stories about outstanding amateur golfers in this episode. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with a good buddy, Bob Bupka. Robert, we had a great talk yesterday with Vinny Giles, who the listeners are going to hear from soon. I know they're going to enjoy what he has to say, and he represents the very best in amateur golfers, doesn't he?
He absolutely does, and what an ambassador to the sport Vinny Giles has been, and you and I both have taken up the cry that, you know, Vinny Giles has to get into the World Golf Hall of Fame with all that he's accomplished. I mean, it's a tragedy that he's not in there already.
Yeah, I agree, and our listeners will hear that later on as we lead into the interview, and then during the interview with Vinny. Amateur golf, Bob. You know, we all play for the love of the game. We certainly here on Musings on Golf spend a fair amount of time talking about the professional game, and for good reason. But for the millions of us who love to play just for the fun of it, for the accomplishments of it, it's what makes golf great. And to be able to watch and learn from some of these great amateur players, Bob Jones obviously comes to mind, Bob, as the greatest amateur golfer of all time. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Bob Jones and what he meant to the game, in addition to, you know, building Augusta National Golf Club and starting the Masters.
Well, Bob Jones just synonymous with amateur golf, all that he accomplished, just an outstanding player. But he was also a wonderful you know, mentor to so many people, also a great ambassador, as I like to say, to the sport of golf. Just tremendous. Where his roots down in Atlanta. You know, Bob Jones retired at age 30, and God only knows what he could have accomplished after that. And ultimately, his biggest accomplishment, the formation of Augusta National Golf Club.
It was interesting in talking to Vinny Giles, who made a decision not to turn professional and went on and gained his law degree from the University of Virginia. And Mr. Jones, an attorney as well, won the Grand Slam back in the 20s when it was, you know, the U.S. Open, the U.S. Amateur, the British Open, and the British Amateur. Never turned professional, and he'll what's neat about it as well to me is the Masters carries that tradition on even today with having amateur golfers every year. It's one of the ways that distinguishes, and I think in a very cool way, Bob, the Masters from the other three major championships.
I couldn't agree with you more, Kelly. It's just a wonderful part of Augusta. That amateurs get to play, and maybe one day we'll even have an amateur get to slip on that green jacket. It wouldn't surprise me, and it wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't happen relatively soon.
I thought we'd take a minute or two just to talk about amateurs that we know and outstanding amateur golfers that we know. I grew up in the D.C. area, and a gentleman by the name of Marty West has been the standard for outstanding amateur golf in the Washington, D.C. area for years. He and I went to the same high school. He took lessons, Bob, from Fred McLeod, who was the longtime head professional at Columbia Country Club in Washington. And by the way, Mr. McLeod won the 1908 U.S. Open. And interesting about Marty, didn't pick up the game of golf until he was 13. Eventually went on and was a two-time All-American at the University of North Carolina. Earlier this year, my dad was inducted into the second Hall of Fame, the Maryland Golf Hall of Fame. Marty was in the initial class last year, and Marty got some tutelage from my dad along the way. And it, you know, Marty won the Maryland Amateur 9 times, won the Maryland Open 3 times. He played on 2 Walker Cup teams. Oh, and he played in 4 Masters, making the cut in 73. How about this number, Bob? Marty West qualified for 38 USGA championships, including two US Opens and two US Senior Opens. It's that level of excellence. And Marty made the decision to raise a family, get into the investment banking world, and steer clear of a life, you know, on the road playing professional golf. But boy, you talk about someone who has made a name for himself and a legacy in golf in the D.C. area and beyond in Marty West.
Yeah, absolutely incredible player, wonderful gentleman, really loved the sport. And you know, basically, when you peel away the onion a little bit on golf, you see it's the amateurs that are playing the sport at their country club and various events. Matter of fact, Kel, you just jogged my memory. It's the 50th anniversary of a story that I'm about to tell, and it involves an amateur, a club pro, and a U.S. Open champion. The date is 1973, and it's yours truly trying to qualify for the Long Island Amateur. I had tried a few years earlier, didn't make it, but in 73, my game was really sharp. I went to Mill River Country Club on Long Island. There were 116 players, and we were battling for 16 spots. I was paired with the reigning club champion at Mill River. I will not use his name, and you'll understand why later on. But all along, during our playing, he was very jovial and very helpful, and, you know, because obviously he's the club champ there. He knew everything about Mill River. Well, sure. His disposition begins to change a little bit as I get tied with him, and then suddenly I'm a stroke ahead of him, and we come to the 18th hole. And I said, "What's this hole?" And he says, "Par 5. So he says, "You can leave your caddy up on top of the hill." So I take my driver, and I walk way down this hill, tell my caddy, "You wait up here." I get down the bottom of the hill on the tee, and I look over, and my partner has a 5-iron. I said, "What is this all about?" Come to find out rather quickly, a very narrow driving hole. Nobody ever uses a driver there, but I was stranded with a driver and my caddy not that close. So what do? I hit it out of bounds, play another ball, and I finish, and I'm disgusted with myself making a double bogey on the last hole. All right, but I had plan B. I was going to go to the U.S. Open at Oakmont that year with my good teaching professional, Bob Joyce, who was with me at Mill River. We ride all the way to Pennsylvania and get to Oakmont, and at 11 o'clock at night, I get a call from the Long Island Golf Association telling me I was the last person in, and I have an 8:10 tee time in the morning to play my first match. I then painfully had to say, "I have to withdraw. I'm nowhere near the area, and there's no way I get back." Well, that was very disappointing, obviously. But then, on the weekend at that U.S. Open at Oakmont, a club pro by the name of Gene Borick has an outstanding round. He shoots 65. It's the talk of the golf world. And then comes Sunday, and Johnny Miller goes out and shoots 63. Nobody heard of Gene Borick ever again after that round, even though he certainly was an outstanding club professional. So there you have it, the amateur, yours truly, not being in the proper place to compete for the first time in the top 16 on Long Island. Then we had the club pro, Gene Borick, and then the incredible U.S. Open victory by Johnny Miller. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. And this year is the 50th anniversary. Hard to believe that many years have gone by.
I love that story. I think that is absolutely terrific. And not by coincidence, I suppose, the low amateur at the 1973 U.S. Open at Oakmont Country Club was Vinnie Giles. And
he mentioned that.
Yeah, we're gonna tee him up in just a minute. But I really appreciate you telling that story, and it speaks to, you know, to me, the so much of what we do as golfers on a daily basis is just enjoy the game, and the love that we have for the game. And in your case, yeah, you might have been in the wrong place, but you had the opportunity to go to the U.S. Open and see a little bit of history there with Johnny Miller on that Sunday.
And one added note to that, I argue that I actually participated in that U.S. Open. Many people disagree. But Tom Joyce, Bob Joyce's brother, had qualified to play in the U.S. Open. We were out at Oakmont about 6 o'clock in the morning. Tom Joyce had one of the first tee times. We were talking with him on the putting green, and he just couldn't make a putt. And he said, "Boy, what am I going to do?" I said, "Boy, I got a putter that would really work for you. I used one of those old bullseyes. The grip was coming off a little bit." But he said, "Where is it?" I said, "It's in the trunk of the car." He says, "Can you get it?" Well, it was about a mile away, so I sprint. And back then, I could sprint. I remember 50 years ago. I get the putter. I bring it back to him. He puts it in his hands. He puts a couple of balls down. He misses all three of the putts. He said, "No, this is not any good." So my question is, did my putter actually participate in that U.S. Open, or did it not?
It had a cameo appearance is the best answer I can give to that.
I'll take
it. Cameo, if nothing else.
I'll take it.
Great stuff. We'll hear now from, or in just a second, we'll hear from Vinny Giles right after you hear from our friends at Titleist.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. You know, Bob, as true amateur golfers are concerned, I don't personally know of anyone more accomplished than our special guest today. Vinny Giles is the only golfer to have won the U.S. Amateur, the British Amateur, and the U.S. Senior Amateur. He's been the low amateur in a Masters and a U.S. Open. He's played on 4 Walker Cup teams and captained another. And quite honestly, I don't know why he is not a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. Nonetheless, Vinny Giles, it's really a treat to welcome you to Musings on Golf. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, Kelly, and great to be with you guys, and spend a little time.
You know, I couldn't think of anybody any better to ask this question to, Vinny. As talented as you were playing this sport, what was the deciding factor or factors in you not turning professional?
Well, I quite honestly, Bob, I guess 1966, when I finished school at the University of Georgia, obviously it was certainly a thought in my process. And I know we've talked about the fact that there wasn't much financial reward in golf back in 1966. I think the total purses on the PGA Tour were, I think, roughly $6.5 million. And as you know, these players today, especially the top players, they wouldn't go across the street to play in a $6 million tournament. But my wife, Key, and I decided that summer to get married. We discussed it. I wanted to do it for personal reasons, just to see if I thought I was as good as I thought I was, or if I were as good as I thought I was. But we looked at the options, and quite honestly, in fact, she said that she wasn't sure she wanted to spend her life in a Holiday Inn. And I said, in hindsight, little did she know that back then the Holiday Inn was about a 4-star. We'd have been a little closer to Motel 6 on that circuit. So I gave it a lot of thought. The other thing that I think had a lot to do with my decision was I love playing golf. I really enjoyed the game. I enjoyed the competition. I enjoyed getting into the heat of battle. And the game was a lot of fun. And I wasn't sure that if I got back into a routine of week to week, you know, 8 to 5, 7 to 6, whatever time you spent playing, practicing, et cetera, that it was really a life I was going to enjoy. And it was at that point I decided I'd see if I could apply to law school and get into law school and get a little background in, I guess, the real world.
Well, it certainly was a wonderful decision as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you established yourself as maybe the greatest amateur that ever played. And what a segue, Vinny. I have to take advantage of your expertise on both sides of the fence as managing players and being a top-notch player yourself. What are your thoughts about all the extra activity that's emanating from the Ryder Cup as far as these players, some saying they're demanding to get paid, others are saying they never said that. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, you go back to, I guess, the late 90s when I know Marco Merrill made the comment that we should all be getting paid. And it quickly was, I guess, poo-pooed. You know, I think it's one of the greatest honors in the world to represent your country in any sport, whether it's golf or the Olympics, et cetera. You know, the 12 guys that play on the Ryder Cup team are all making 8 figures plus. So what's the number? I mean, what do they want? X, Y, Z? They don't need the money. And I think that's what's killing the game today is it's all about the money. And I was talking to somebody, actually a player agent the other day, and the question of who was making what. And I said, well, what does Scotty Scheffler make? He's the number one player in the world. I don't know Scotty Scheffler. He's obviously a very nice guy. He's not a big needle mover. And his answer was, I think he made about $40 million. Well, I mean, how much do you need? And I go, you know, I go on to one of my favorites, being Rory McIlroy, who I see a lot during the winter down in Florida and play golf a lot with his father. Heck, he's got to be making at least double that. But I don't think he's all about the money. One of the complaints that I've heard from players is, well, the PGA Tour gets $20 million out of the Ryder Cup, and we don't get any. Well, technically, they've got to get some just in the retirement program. But more importantly, I keep coming back to the same thing, Bob. They don't need more money. And if you're not proud enough to play for your country, then take your name out of the hat and let somebody else play. They also forget that every one of them, and I don't know the number, but every one of them got a pretty nice bonus from their various contractual sponsors to make the Ryder Cup team. So go let somebody research that and see how much money each one of them made in addition to what they were already being paid.
Well, and hey, Vinny, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard none of those type of issues on the European side. I've heard nothing money-wise, financially, in terms of that Rory said anything, Rahm, et cetera. It seems like a completely night and day scenario.
Well, I think that's a legitimate observation, and I think that might tell you a little bit about why the team room on the European side is probably a little more enjoyable than the one on the U.S. side.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of enjoyable, Vinny. Millions of people have enjoyed your amateur career. I'm interested to kind of find out how you got started in golf back in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Well, my father was a good player, and this was in the early 50s. I was already playing a fair amount of competitive golf at the junior level. I started out caddying when I was about 8. I played golf every Monday with the caddies. Our club allowed the caddies to play all day Monday, and most of our caddies were black. They were great guys. They were almost mentors to me. And one of them would pick me up every Monday morning in the summer about 7:30. And we'd play golf till he had to go back to work at the Lynchburg Foundry on his night shift. So I was pretty much into the game, Bob. I mean, competitively at about 8 years old. And I loved it. I spent all day long in the summers doing nothing but playing holes and chipping and putting. And we didn't have a golf professional. You kind of learn by watching. When I was caddying, I would try to always watch the best players and see what they did well and how they did it well. And it just grew from that. It never was really I don't know why. I just thought it was pretty, pretty neat. And golf wasn't cool back then, as you know. All the way through high school, we didn't have a high school golf team where I went to school. In fact, I ran track in the spring. But I played summer tournaments, none of the big ones. I never tried to qualify for the USGA Junior, et cetera, because the trips were too expensive back then. We had this International Junior Chamber of Commerce tournament. And if you qualified top four in your state, you went to the national. The first one I played in was at the Scarlet Course at Ohio State. And this young, heavyset, blonde-headed kid won it by about 10 shots. I remember playing.
Name of Nicholas, right?
I think that was his name. certainly close to that. And I remember playing the golf course, and I think I was 14. I think there was 6 par fours I couldn't reach in 2. he was probably hitting wedges to
them. Oh, golly. But there had to come a point, Vinny, when you knew that you were getting really good at golf. Is there a specific time period or a particular round or a particular tournament that message became very clear?
Well, I won the Virginia State Amateur when I was 19, and that was back then was a big deal. And that was when you might get to it later, but I'll go ahead of you. I had actually started college that year at the University of North Carolina, and after about a year of, I had a very good background in educational background in a small prep school in Virginia. And my first year at Chapel Hill was pretty easy. My second year, I thought it was going to be easy too, and it wasn't. And I'd sort of forgotten where the classroom was. So I went by it, but I never went in it. So I dropped out of school right after Thanksgiving and was going to go back in the fall. I was working in Lynchburg, and I got a phone call from a golf coach at the University of Georgia. And a story I've told more times than I can remember, but not to a whole lot of people. And he said, "I understand you're a good player." And it was after I'd won the state amateur. And I said, "Well, sir, I don't know if I'm a good player or not." He said, "Well, I've got a kid on my team who's the best player I have, and he says he can't beat you." And it's a young man who used to come up to Lynchburg to visit all summer. And he said, "I'm losing 5 seniors. If you'll come down to Athens, Georgia next week, I'll give you tuition and books for the spring quarter, and I'll give you a full ride starting in the fall." And I didn't think much more about it. I didn't know where Athens, Georgia was. And I went home that evening, and I'm having dinner with my mother and father and sister. And my father's about 6'3", and one of my closest friends, but he was also a tough SOB. And I told the story. I'm kind of laughing about it. And Daddy had on these half glasses. He looked down over the half glass. He said, "Son, how fast can you pack your bag?" And I looked at him like, "Wait, what?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I've been paying these tuition bills and these fraternity bills." And he said, "I haven't seen any results." Long story short, 5 days later, Vinnie Giles, with five little pieces of luggage, gets on a train to go to Athens, Georgia. So I thought I'd be smart. I'd go get off in Gainesville. That was closer and cheaper. So I get off the train in Gainesville. I go to the station master, and I said, "Sir, what time's the next train go to Athens?" He looked at me, said, "Son, don't know trains go to Athens." I said, "No problem." I said, "Where's the Greyhound station?" "Don't matter. Don't know buses go to Athens either." So here I am on this little local road with a shag bag, a little Sunday golf bag, two little suitcases, and a hanging bag, hitchhiking to Athens, Georgia. So that's how I got to the University of Georgia. And when I got there, the golf team was on spring break in Florida playing golf. And I stayed in somebody's apartment and walked up to what now would be a 7-Eleven to have my meals. It was quite an introduction.
What an introduction indeed. Vinnie Giles, the great amateur golfer, joining us on Musings on Golf. Was it just one car ride that took you to Athens, or did you have to hitchhike multiple times?
No, it was a very short, it was only about 45 miles, and somebody in a pickup truck picked me up, and from then I started riding around in friends' cars because I didn't have a car.
Well, you had a lot of game, though. Three times All-American at the University of Georgia. Hey, Vinny, what stands out, what memory, great memory or memories do you have from those, what had to be great days as they turned out in Athens playing for the Bulldogs?
Well, I think, Kelly, if you want to say when did you find out how to really play golf, it was at Georgia. We mm-hmm. played, as you can imagine, every day. We played and practiced. We had little money games, which was kind of your beer money. I found out that I could play with better players and be competitive. And I would have to credit University of Georgia really with taking my game to the next level. We had a great time and had great guys on our teams. We won the Southeastern Conference all 3 years I played. We didn't ever really do a heck of a lot in the NCAA. In fact, my senior year, I finished second in the NCAA to Bob Murphy at Stanford. And Georgia wouldn't even send a team. They sent two individuals. But that's the difference in, 50-plus years ago and where golf is today. And these college golf teams are flying around in Boone Pickens' plane or somebody else's plane and having, it's just a different world.
Well, we're so thrilled to be joined by Vinnie Giles here on Musings on Golf. You had great success in Walker Cups, being paired with Steve Melnick and then with Gary Koch. What worked so well with each guy?
Well, we were friends, first and foremost. And, Bob, I've always said, with all due respect to these teams, whether it's Ryder Cup or Walker Cup, you somewhat pair personalities. It's all about the chemistry. And Steve and I were good friends going. I mean, we played as partners in 69 and 71. And Gary Koch is one of my closest friends. We played in 73 and 75. In fact, Gary stayed around an extra year before turning pro just to make another Walker Cup team. And I just, you know, as I say, we had good chemistry. We had each other's back, and nobody fussed about it. Well, I guess in 69, when Melnick and I played, we were the first American team off at Milwaukee Country Club in the alternate shot. And I was hitting the first drive for the U.S. Flag went up, announcements were made. I was nervous as a cat, probably one of the two most nervous times I've ever stood on a first tee. And I proceeded to hit a quick breaking hook off the tee. And we walked off the tee, and, you know, Melnick said, with a lot of people around, Melnick says, no problem. First tee at Milwaukee went straight down a hill under the tee, and there weren't any people walking down there. He turned to me, he said, you son of a bitch. But we just had good chemistry. I mean, Gary Koch today is still one of my closest friends. I mean, he's been a client and a friend for over 50 years. And I still was doing his NBC golf telecast contract up until, in their infinite wisdom, NBC decided to get rid of Gary Koch and Roger Maltby and take their broadcast team into the toilet. But, we're just great pals. I talk to him probably once a week, and it's as I say, I still think it's chemistry. I don't think it's who hits what shot which way. So,
hey Vinny, next time you talk to Gary Koch, say, what the heck is Bob Bupka's picture doing in your office? When he won out in Las Vegas, I was covering the event. They took the winning photograph. I happened to be in it. And every time I see Gary, Gary will say, I'm tired of looking at you, Bob. You've been hanging in my office for a long, long time. One of the real good guys out there, though. Gary is.
I tell you, they don't get any better than Gary Koch, both personally and professionally. I'll go to my grave saying he's as good as they've ever been.
And what were the crowds like for amateur golf back in the 60s and early 70s? I remember it as being very popular.
Oh, no question, Bob. I mean, amateur, you know, back in those days, there were career amateurs. I mean, Harvey Ward, other than until the USGA suspended him, was a career amateur. Bill Campbell, Billy Joe Patton, Bill Hindman, Ed Tutwiler. I mean, you can go on and on. I mean, Dean Beeman was an amateur for a long time. We had really good crowds at Walker Cups in the U.S., respectable crowds in the U.S. Amateur. And boy, when you went across the pond, I mean, I remember playing in my first overseas Walker Cup was 71 at St. Andrews. And you had people like Sir Michael Benalla, who was a legend, just as you know, just passed away. In golf in the UK, Roddy Carr, the son of Joe Carr, who was the most decorated Irish amateur ever, was on that team. And we had 10 or 12,000 people out there, and they were following, you know, we only played, eight players in the foursomes, and we played, obviously we played only eight in the singles. So you had that many people following that few games, and it was a circus almost. It really was.
We talked earlier about your decision to remain an amateur in 73 at Oakmont. You were the low amateur there, and Johnny Miller, obviously everyone knows, closed with 63 and an amazing score on one of the truly great and demanding golf courses anywhere. But you know, you mentioned about the purses. Johnny won $35,000 in 1973 for winning the U.S. Open. That was the total amount of money. So maybe that kind of puts it into context a little bit in terms of your decision not to pursue life as a professional golfer.
Well, it certainly wasn't lucrative. That's interesting, Kelly. I didn't realize it was that small a purse. I actually I played two groups in front of him that day with Lanny Watkins, who happened to shoot 65, and nobody ever talked about it. But you know, it was it really is hard to fathom. I don't even know what does the winner win now. What's the purse? $20 million. And they win 18. Yeah,
the purse that year at the Open was about $219,000 with $35,000 going to to Miller. Yeah, these guys, many tour events this year were $20 million purses.
Oh yeah, no, $3.6 million purse prize was not uncommon this year.
Hey Vinny, let me share a story with you about that 73 Open at Oakmont. I happened to be there, and I don't know if you remember, on Saturday, a club pro from Long Island by the name of Gene Bark, he was a heck of a player, but he shot 65, and it was the biggest story at Oakmont. A club pro shoots 65, and then the next day, Johnny Miller puts up that 63, and end of Gene Bark. But that was a tough golf course, and that round by Johnny Miller was incredible.
Well, Bob, I don't know when you last were at Oakmont, but the 73 golf course compared to the 2022 or 3 golf course, it's not even the same animal. It is so hard now, it is beyond belief.
Well, I don't think I'll go to play then. I like easy golf courses.
I used to go up there and play in a little Monday thing that Stan Druckenmiller put on called the SWAT. And somebody said, "What do you enjoy the most about it?" I said, "Get walking off the 18th green." It was brutal.
Finishing in one piece, right?
Exactly.
Hey, Vinny, before we were known as Musings on Golf, we were Musings on Sports, and Donald Dell was a guest on our program then, and Donald, great tennis player, member of the Tennis Hall of Fame, and then he went on to start ProServe, and it seems to me you followed in some of those footsteps in a sense, and that you know you went to UVA Law School, you graduated, and then later on you opened Pros Inc. You represented the likes of Gary, Tom Kite, Lanny Watkins, Beth Daniel, Meg Mallon. What was that the intent when you went to law school to eventually start your own representation firm for top professional players?
No, Kelly, it really wasn't. In fact, I went to law school just to get an education, I guess you'd say. I knew, you know, my primary education at the University of Georgia was probably golf. Yeah. It's not that I was a terrible student. I just, you know, it was not my main focus. And possibly professional golf was my focus at the time. But when I decided not to try the tour, I said, you know, I've got to go get some background. And I looked at law school. Somebody said, go to business school. And I said, that's really not my thing. But I've always said law school, I'm probably the luckiest thing I ever did, because it taught you how to deal with issues. You took a fact situation, you broke it down, and you figured out how to solve it. And I think that's true in life, period. I mean, just figuring out what the issue is and then figuring out how to deal with it. So when I left law school, I actually went to work in the investment business. I was in the what they then called corporate syndicate, which was underwriting IPOs and that sort of thing. And I was still playing a lot of competitive golf. I mean, this was 1969, the year of my third straight second place finish in the U.S. Amateur, which was not winning. And I started having young guys that were playing the tour who, you know, IMG was the benchmark back then. And, They came to me and said, so typical. Well, you know, you're a lawyer and you're in the investment business, so you must really know something. And I was thinking, I don't know a damn thing. But but I guess I'm fooling people. And they said, would you help us with some things? Because IMG back then was charging clients not only percentages of endorsements, but also percentages of prize money. And, I mean, you look at Miller in 73, he wasn't an IMG client, but say he was, he wins $35,000, they would have taken $3,500 out of that pie. And we started helping a couple of young guys. Alan Miller was one of them. Bobby Watkins was local. Lanny was a client of the same firm that Miller was at the time. And my friend Vernon Spratley and I, who were both working for Wheat First Securities, I started saying, you know, let's have some fun with this thing. And it picked up. And finally in 73, I just said, what the heck? I'm 30 years old. It looks like it could be something we could be successful doing. And if it doesn't work, and let's say you go 3 to 5 years, it doesn't work, you're only 35. Yeah, you can do something else. So we started in the April of 73, representing two or three players. We were doing everything. We were doing baseball, football, basketball, anything would consulting, anything would pay a bill. And then 75, we signed Gary Cope, George Burns, and Jerry Pate out of the Q School. And they were the 1, 2, and 3 finishers at the Q School. And all of a sudden, Pros Inc. was on the map. And, you know, it just kind of grew from there. And about 85, we decided to do 100% golf. We gave the baseball and team sport clients to a young man who was working with us and to set up his own firm. And, I guess, you know, in 1999, we sold Pros Inc. to Octagon.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Well, it made a lot of sense. Hey, no, sorry, Bob, go right ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to go off script here because he mentioned a name, George Burns. And I have to share this story with you about George Burns. I was in an invitational at National Golf Links of America. I won my first two matches. Third match, I come up against George Burns. Now, I was a radio broadcaster out on Long Island. George Burns went to NIAC Prep. His roommate was Johnny Carson's son, and the coach came up to me before the football game, and he said, you know, this Burns family donates a lot of money to the school. If you could make him sound good, I'd appreciate it. So I guarantee you, George Burns made more tackles, more blocks, more interceptions than any player in history because of my call. We fast forward to National Golf Links of America, and the first player I play against, I had only heard about him. His name was Lord Taylor. He was reputed to be the richest member of National. I'm on the first tee. I'm nervous as hell, and I'm washing my ball in the ball washer to get ready. George, richest guy, what the heck, Lord Taylor, comes up to the first tee, says to his caddy, throw me 2 sleeves. And I watch the caddy throws Lord Taylor 6 brand new Titleist. And if you're familiar with National, if you tee off backwards, it goes out into Peconic Bay. So here he is. He's hitting 6 brand new Titleist into Peconic Bay, and I'm washing the ball that I'm going to play against him.
you should have chased him, Bob. Yeah,
I didn't have my scuba tank. And the only source of income I had in those days, believe it or not, my parents owned a grocery store in Sag Harbor, not too far away, and I came across the idea of putting an ice machine outside the store. And, boy, I was doing really well. This is way back when. I was making $200-$300 a week just taking money out of this ice machine, putting more ice in it. My second match, I'm playing a guy by the name of Piper, and we're walking down the first fairway, and I said, what kind of business you in, Piper? He said, you know, He didn't want to answer me, and I kept pressing him. He said, well, my family owns Piper Aircraft. I said, Piper Aircraft? Holy mackerel. He says to me, what business you in, Bob? I said, Piper, right now, all my assets are frozen. And he said, "What?" He said, that's not a good position to be in. But the point of the story, George Burns beats me. And he actually, after the match, he said, hey, Bob, he says, you're a big-time radio announcer. He said, I got a speeding ticket from the state police. Anything you can do to fix it? I said, well, I'll try, George. So 35 years, Vinny, 35 years goes by, and there's an event in New Jersey, I think at Ridgeway, and George Burns is playing. I pull in the parking lot. I look over the putting green. I said to Janice, my partner, wow, there's George Burns. I'm going to go say hello. So I start walking over. I get to the edge of the putting green. George Burns stops, drops his putter, and he says, well, there he is. Can't fix a parking ticket, Bubka. I said, damn, George, that was 35 years ago. I never heard anybody carry a grudge that long.
Well, consider the source.
Yeah.
These are unbelievable stories. Hey, we're going to wrap this up. Vinny, I've got one. I know Bob wants to close with a question about the year in 93 when you captained the Walker Cup team. Final question for me, and I've heard this from a number of players. Bob Ford, the legendary PGA professional at both Oakmont and Seminole, have said that you, Vinny Giles, are the greatest bunker player ever. And I will take Bob at his word. I'm interested, who taught you to be such a great bunker player? And what are the fundamentals that you focus on when you're playing a bunker shot?
Well, Kelly, maybe one of the biggest problems is I must have been in a hell of a lot.
I didn't want to say that.
But, you know, I look at I go back to 1975. I remember I was playing a practice round. Bob, you'll find this more interesting. It's more your vintage. I'm playing a practice round in the old American Golf Classic at Firestone.
Uh-huh.
75, I'd been invited as a sponsor's exemption. And I had this friend of mine who owned a Coca-Cola bottling company in Akron. He set up a practice round. It was Chichi Rodriguez, Lee Trevino, and Tommy Bolt.
Wow.
And I'm going to tell you what, if you could have been a fly on the end of that driver, you would have heard some real commentary that day. But, I remember hitting the bunker on the 13th hole, and I've got up short-sided, and I'm getting ready to hit this bunker shot. And I didn't really know Lee Trevino. I knew Chichi a little bit. And Trevino says, what are you doing? I said, I'm getting ready to hit this bunker shot. He said, open the face. I said, I've got the face open. He said, open the face. And I felt like I rolled it way more open. Opened the goddamn face. And I got the back of the wedge parallel to the sand. And I mean, I just thought more about it. And that's one of the things, Kelly, that is critical. Nobody opens the face of the club enough. Now, granted, if you've got a longer shot, you don't open as much. But I will say, playing Seminole, you better be good out of the bunkers. And part of it is your setup and your face angle. A large part of it is no different than putting. You got to believe that you can hit these shots. Mm-hmm. Some of it's imagination, a lot of it's feel, and obviously some of it's instinct. But the simplicity of it, it's a slightly open stance. It's a ball position depending on the shots you're trying to hit. And it's an out-to-in move. I mean, the club comes up and away from you. Mm-hmm. You keep the face open, and you're basically hitting a slice. I mean, you're cutting across the ball. You're just trying to cut the legs right out from under the ball, hitting, you know, an inch behind the ball. And continuing your face angle's got to stay scoured all the way through the shot.
My final question, one, is that simplicity of that bunker shot, is that the way that you played your game in general? Were you did you think a lot? Did you work a lot on mechanics, or was that more of the way you played your entire game?
I was totally instinctive. I mean, I look and act. Imagination. I mean, I'm not worth a toot anymore around the greens, except in the bunkers. But at the height of my success, or whatever you want to call it, I thought I could get the ball up and down from a ball washer or a garbage can. And it was all instinct. It was all feel. And I think, especially around the greens, imagination is a tremendous, I mean, sure, confidence is the key, but imagination is critical. I mean, you watch these guys today, and 95% of them are really, really just wizards around the greens.
Incredible.
But the equipment's so much different. I mean, we never heard of a 64-degree wedge. We played with a pitching wedge and a sand wedge. And a sand wedge was probably in the neighborhood of 56 degrees. It didn't have a number on it. It didn't have a bounce on it. It was just a club that you learned how to use, and you use the face angle according to the nature of the shot. And nowadays, I mean, you know, there's not a player on that tour that doesn't have a wedge with at least 64-degree loft on it. Equipment's different, as you well know. I mean, it's easier to play with than it used to be.
Well, you made it look easy, Vinnie Giles, and you made it easy on our listeners of Musings on Golf to be able to dig into the background of somebody that I, for one, thoroughly deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And I think you feel the same way, Kelly.
As I said at the outset, I do. If you look at the list of members of the World Golf Hall of Fame, there are very few pure amateur golfers who are members. And Vinny, I have told this to many people. I'm sure there are a lot of advocates on your side, and you're too much of a Southern gentleman to push too hard, but you darn well should be a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame in this guy's humble opinion.
Well, you're very kind. I appreciate it. And you're right. There are very few amateurs recognized. And unfortunately, it is a shame, because without amateurs, those guys wouldn't be making those stupid numbers of dollars they're making. So I rest my case.
Yes.
Vinny, I'm going to let Kelly close it out, but I have to say, we've been very fortunate on Musings on Golf to talk to a lot of fascinating people. You're right up near the top there, my friend. You've been a class act, a first-class gentleman, and a wonderful ambassador for the sport of golf. And for that, I thank you.
Well, I thank you. That's awful, awful high praise. I'm not sure it's deserved.
Hey, Vinny, in closing, and I will ask the question in regards to your captaincy of the Walker Cup, 93 at Interlochen in Minnesota. Not only did you captain the team, it was the largest margin of victory in Walker Cup history, 14 points. You accomplished many, many things on the golf course. Was that, being the captain of a victorious Walker Cup team, was that the career highlight for you?
Kelly, I'll be honest with you. It was a great, great honor. To me, it was a long time coming. I felt like it probably should have happened earlier, but I had the USGA kind of out of my corner, and primarily because of Sandy Tatum. But that's story for another day.
Sure.
I would put it. I'd actually put it third. Having finished second in the U.S. Amateur 3 years in a row, winning the U.S. Amateur was a highlight of my golf career. And I always say, people laugh, say, well, what is your second favorite victory? And my father died of leukemia when he was 66. And when he was 65, he and I won the father-son tournament, which was actually a national tournament, but primarily local in Virginia. And to see tears in his eyes for only the second time ever was, you know, that was very special to me. So, I mean, I loved everything about the Walker Cup. I still love everything about the Walker Cup. And I've gone to the last five or six. I mean, going back to Lytham with Spider Miller, going up to this year with Mike McCoy at St. Andrews. And it's special in my mind. So, yeah, it was a special treat. But as I say, probably number three.
Well, you're number one in our books, and it's been just a real, real treat to have you. Vinnie Giles, thank you so much for joining us on Musings on Golf. We look forward to seeing you down the road, not too far. I'll see you, I would imagine, perhaps at Seminole before too long.
Won't be long, because we'll be there in about a month.
Yes, sir.
Thanks to both of you. It's been a pleasure.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Boy, Bob, it's been a fascinating life that Vinnie Giles has led, representing players at the highest level professionally. But his accomplishments on the golf course is what has made him stand out. Again, I'm not sure why he isn't in the World Golf Hall of Fame, but I'm going to lobby the best I can to get him there.
Yeah, well, I think it should be a successful lobby because his accomplishments on the golf course absolutely qualify him for Hall of Fame status.
Well, we thank Vinnie Giles for spending a terrific period of time with us. For my good friend Bob Bupka, the amateur golfer, Kelly Elbin, another amateur golfer, signing off. Thanks for joining us. Musings on Golf.